The headlines: a unanimous condemnation from the UN Security Council over the killing of Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh, and a call for an impartial investigation. Russia cuts Finland's electricity supply 2 days after the nation announces its bid to join NATO. Plus, Senator Rand Paul gets in the way of the U.S. Congress approving a mega aid package, saying Washington cannot save Ukraine by dooming its own economy. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumisha Ahmadi, and these are top stories this hour. The United Nations Security Council has condemned the killing of Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. The 15-member UN body issued a unanimous condemnation on Friday. The Security Council called for an immediate, thorough, transparent, and impartial investigation into Abu Akleh's killing. She was a journalist at the Arabic language channel of the Qatar-based Al Jazeera TV network. Abu Akleh, 51 years old, was fatally shot while covering an Israeli army raid in the city of Jenin on Wednesday. She was wearing a press vest and standing with other journalists when targeted. The killing has sparked international outcry, with calls growing for Israel to be held accountable for the murder of the veteran reporter. Thousands of Palestinians have held a funeral for veteran journalist Shirin Abu Akleh, who was killed by Israeli forces. Abu Akleh was laid to rest in a cemetery in occupied East Al-Quds. Tensions simmered at the beginning of her funeral. Israeli forces attacked mourners trying to carry Abu Akleh's casket from a hospital to her funeral service in a church. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas is calling for a quick formation of a single unified command to lead field battles with the Israeli regime. The head of the political bureau of Hamas, Ismail Haniyeh, is calling on the Palestinian Authority to stop security cooperation with Israel. Haniyeh says Palestinian Authority should focus on a comprehensive resistance plan to counter the regime. He says this needs a firm and strategic decision against Israel as Palestinians confront the regime on all levels. The senior Hamas official also says the Palestinian Authority should abolish the Oslo Accords, in which it recognized the existence of Israel. His comments come on the eve of the anniversary of the formation of Israel on Palestinian lands, which Palestinians mark as Nakba, or Day of Disaster. And a Palestinian young man has succumbed to the wounds that he sustained during an Israeli attack on Al-Aqsa Mosque last month. Walid al-Sharif is among dozens of Palestinians killed over the past few weeks as Israel has intensified its attacks in the occupied territories. Mona Kendall has the details.
Well, let's say the martyrdom of al-Sharif had brought to Palestinians these awful memories and painful days during the holy month of Ramadan. It's day after day. We can say that almost every day here in the occupied territories, Israeli forces are shooting and killing Palestinians in cold blood. So it wasn't al-Sharif only who succumbed to his injuries. The day before, there was a Palestinian who was killed in the Jenin area. And there is also the killing in cold blood of Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh. Israeli forces this morning have raided as well several Palestinian areas in the occupied West Bank. But even if every day there is a Palestinian being killed by the Israeli forces, Palestinians insist that nothing would end their insistence to continue the struggle and to continue resisting the occupation forces, especially that all Palestinian resistance groups and Palestinians from all walks of life today are united on one thing, that the Israeli occupation must come to an end.
May 14th marks the fourth anniversary of the relocation of the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Al-Quds. Donald Trump relocated the U.S. Embassy a day ahead of the Nakba that marks the creation of Israel. Each year, Palestinians hold rallies to denounce the event and Israel's occupation of their land. We're joined by our correspondent in Gaza, Ashraf Shannon, for more details. Now, Ashraf, the relocation of the embassy, tell us more about that.
Yes, so 4 years ago on this day, the U.S. administration relocated its embassy from Tel Aviv to occupied Al-Quds, prompting angry reactions in the Gaza Strip as tens of thousands of peaceful protesters were taking part in the Great March of Return rallies as U.S. officials were inaugurating the new embassy in occupied Al-Quds. Israeli regime forces opened live fire on the peaceful protesters in the east of the enclave in Gaza City, instantly killing 63 peaceful protesters, including children, women, and elderly people. In the following weeks, at least six more people who were wounded on May 14th also succumbed to their wounds. So around 70 protesters were killed as Palestinians were angrily reacting to the relocation of the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Al-Quds. The peaceful protesters were taking part in the Great March of Return rally. The return refers to the return of Palestinian refugees to their original towns and homes, of which their ancestors were kicked out of by Zionist gangs in 1948 upon the creation of the Israeli regime. 4 years ago, when that Israeli massacre took place in the east of the enclave, Palestinians, it took place on the eve of Nakba Day, or the day of catastrophe. Tomorrow, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, in the occupied West Bank and occupied Al-Quds, and around the world, will be marking the 74th anniversary of Nakba Day, or the day of catastrophe, that refers to the creation of the Israeli regime on occupied Palestinian lands in May of 1948. We've seen that almost every Nakba anniversary, Israelis express more brutality against the Palestinians, trying to affirm their hold on occupied Palestinian lands, Giso.
Okay, so can you tell us more, Ashraf, about the events that have been scheduled for Nakba Day, rallies, anything special going on?
Well, I guess for tomorrow, there'll be a big rally taking place in Gaza held by the Palestinian resistance factions, and definitely almost everywhere around the world rallies will be held. And also that rallies and events are taking place before and after Nakba Day, because for Palestinians it's one of the most important days of their calendar, as it reminds the young generations of the roots in occupied Palestine, as grandfathers and fathers tell their children and grandchildren about the suffering that they've been going through for more than seven decades now, Giso.
Thank you very much. That was our correspondent, Ashraf Shannon, from Gaza. A Syrian military source says the country's air defenses have actively engaged in a barrage of Israeli missiles in the northwestern province of Hama. Most of the missiles were reportedly intercepted in the Masyafa region of Hama. The military source added that the Israeli attack killed five people and wounded seven others, including a child. The regime frequently launches raids inside Syria. Damascus has repeatedly complained to the United Nations, saying that the attacks are a violation of its sovereignty and international law. It says Israel carries out the strikes to prop up terrorist groups in Syria. Damascus says international silence and U.S. support have emboldened the regime. Our correspondent in the Syrian capital, Damascus, Mohammad Ali, has given us a more detailed picture of the aftermath of these attacks.
It's not just Israel. Take, for example, Turkey, which is also invading Syria, occupying Syria, and targeting civilian areas, and the Syrian army aiding and supporting terrorists over here. It's similar to what Israel is also doing. Countries like Turkey and Israel are directly supporting terrorist groups in Syria for their own interests. Eventually, they have a mutual enemy, which is the Syrian army and the Syrian people, apparently, because those who are being affected directly are the civilians. Civilians are being killed. Their houses are being attacked. They are being displaced as a result and killed as a result of such attacks, whether it's Turkey, the U.S., or Israel. They're all attacking Syria, and they're doing that for their own interests. At the end of the day, there is international silence, despite that such attacks and such occupation is against international law and Syria's sovereignty. And despite all of the letters that Syria sent to the United Nations, those countries continue to violate the independence of sovereign countries. And eventually, nothing is happening on the ground. No one is stopping them internationally.
Moving on, Finland's grid company Fingrid says that Russia has cut electricity deliveries to the country. Fingrid earlier said that it cannot make payments for the imported electricity without specifying the reason. The development comes 2 days after Finland announced its bid to join the Western military alliance, NATO. Finnish leaders called for the membership without delay. Sweden has announced the same bid. Both are concerned after Russia launched the war in Ukraine. Moscow, however, says that there is no real reason for Finland and Sweden to join NATO, as Russia has no hostile intentions towards them. Russia, at the same time, has warned of precautionary measures if NATO deploys nuclear forces and infrastructure closer to its borders. Top Republican Senator Rand Paul has single-handedly blocked a U.S. Congress vote on an additional aid package for Ukraine, delaying the bill until next week.
My oath of office is to the U.S. Constitution, not to any foreign nation. And no matter how sympathetic the cause, my oath of office is to the national security of the United States of America. We cannot save Ukraine by dooming the U.S. economy. Our military aid to Ukraine is nothing new, though. Since 2014, the United States has provided more than $6 billion in security assistance to Ukraine, in addition to the $14 billion Congress authorized just a month ago. If this bill passes, the U.S. will have authorized roughly $60 billion.
Paul faced backlash from his Democratic and Republican colleagues, but he remained adamant. He says if the bill is passed, the U.S. aid to Ukraine will be equal to the entire military budget of Russia. He argued the money is not something lying around in the U.S., but has to be borrowed from China. The bill would send some $40 billion in military and financial assistance to Ukraine. It was already passed by the U.S. House. President Joe Biden has said that he needed the money by the end of this week to help Ukraine in the ongoing war with Russia. In a letter, secretaries of state and defense also urged lawmakers to approve the package. They warned the remaining authorized aid funds would run out by May 19. John Stepling, author and commentator, is joining us right now. Mr. Stepling, the U.S. is dealing with a record inflation in 40 years, from high food and gas prices to problems like a baby formula shortage. Do you believe that Senator Paul's view that the U.S. cannot save Ukraine by dooming its own economy is a justified concern?
Well, I mean, certainly the idea that the U.S. sending $60 billion to Ukraine is insanity. But let's look at the context for all of this. The U.S. in 2014 orchestrated the coup that removed a Russian-friendly president and put in a Western-friendly president in Ukraine. That pleased the IMF and Western capital immensely, and that was one of the motive forces. But the U.S. wanted to expand NATO, and they've wanted that for, you know, the last 60 years, and that's what they've done, constantly expand eastward. And Russia has expressed its concerns throughout since 2014. They've gone to the UN and asked for peacekeepers and so forth because of the shelling of Donbass. But this money, I mean, the U.S. right now is in economic freefall. We're looking at a crisis of homelessness, poverty. Oxfam released a study recently, something like half a billion people globally are being thrown into extreme poverty. In the U.S., the COVID lockdowns, which saw a monopolization of retail, but also saw the loss of millions of jobs. Mom and pop stores went under, 1 in 3 museums closed, et cetera, et cetera. Restaurants closed. Oil and gas prices have increased. People can't afford to drive their cars anywhere. Building materials have increased exponentially. And there are no jobs. There's massive unemployment. So we're seeing collapsing bridges, you know, unrepaired roads. This has gone on for a number of years. It's just reaching a point of crisis now. And yet Biden is sending billions to Ukraine for a war that is completely pointless from any rational perspective. And we're seeing the massive propaganda rolled out by the West again. Rand Paul is right in the way that a broken clock is right twice a day. This is one of his right moments. But it's not going to change anything. The money will be approved and the money will be sent to Ukraine and they'll buy more weapons. And then we're seeing Sweden and Finland joining NATO. These are decisions that are made in Washington and London, not in Helsinki and Stockholm.
Thank you very much. That was Mr. John Stepling, author and commentator, joining us. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered on April 12, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic. It should not be the case that we are popular in the beginning, but later on become tired. No, you should really remain popular. I do not mean that you should definitely continue these provincial trips until the end of your term. They might stop at some point, and this is all right. Popularity is not confined to provincial trips. Being in contact with the people and hearing from them are also manifestations of popularity. Sometimes one hears from ordinary people points that one does not hear from veteran and experienced experts, and one benefits from their viewpoints more. Being in contact with the people and popular reports have this advantage. Another point which I would like to place great emphasis on is the policies on Article 44 of the Constitution, which were announced a few years ago and which everyone spoke highly of, but they have not been acted on. Different administrations have been reminded of this, and they each said that they intended to act on it. But the policies on Article 44 have not been acted on in the true sense of the word. The economy of the country must be truly in the hands of the people, and the administration should only play its supervisory role without playing an executive role. This is very important.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Sometimes you put a load on your own shoulder and decide to carry it from a city to another. And sometimes you put it inside a fast vehicle and you drive it. The second one is correct. The fast and active vehicle is the entrepreneur of the country. We must activate these, but you should supervise their work, formulate policies, and take care not to let a mistake be made. However, you must let them work. Both the entrepreneur, the people, and you, as government officials, will benefit from this. This is one issue. Another issue which is very important and which is a long-term project is the issue of economic growth without oil. Just like the countries which do not have any oil and which have a good rate of economic growth and progress, and they are not small in number either, this addictive drug, that is oil, has made us addicted since 100 years ago. It is really a difficult form of addiction.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The British government has been accused of trading people like commodities after Prime Minister Boris Johnson announced last month that the migrants and asylum seekers illegally entering Britain will be sent thousands of miles away to Rwanda as part of a deal with the African country.
From today, our new migration and economic development partnership will mean that anyone entering the UK illegally, as well as those who have arrived illegally since January the 1st, may now be relocated to Rwanda.
Welcome, and this is Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. This week, we are focusing on Britain's controversial plans to deport asylum seekers to Rwanda. Now, human rights activists are saying that this deal is cruel, immoral, neo-colonial, likely unlawful, and a threat to the lives of refugees. So what are the real reasons behind this deal, and is London imitating a similar arrangement that the Israeli regime had with Rwanda? Is this agreement part of a plan by Boris Johnson to divert attention from the embarrassment of his Partygate scandal? These are some of the questions which I'll be asking our experts today.
Inhuman UK-Rwanda Refugee Pact. The United Kingdom is under harsh criticism over its plan to send illegal immigrants and asylum seekers thousands of miles away to Rwanda. Last month, Britain announced a deal with Rwanda to send asylum seekers to the East African country, claiming the measure would stop people smugglers sending desperate migrants on treacherous journeys across the English Channel. Prime Minister Boris Johnson claims that Rwanda will have the capacity to resettle tens of thousands of people in the years ahead.
The UK has promised Rwanda an initial £120 million as part of what has been termed as an economic transformation and integration program. Now, this payment has been equated to a slave trade agreement. Rwandan opposition leader Frank Habineza has slammed Britain's decision to send refugees to his country, terming it as inhumane and a violation of human rights.
We are competing against these kind of deals, whether it's Denmark or UK or Israel or whatever. We are not in agreement. If people come to you, take care of them. We have signed the UN Convention, all of us, to take care of refugees. It's really inhumane and also against human rights. Because if it's the right of the people to go where they have gone, so if you send them to a country where they do not choose, that means you're forcing them to go somewhere elsewhere. So that's against their rights. It's an abuse of human rights as well. So we have to respect their rights and the rights of refugees.
For more on this controversial Rwanda-UK refugee deal, we contacted Claude Gatebuke, the executive director of the Africa Great Lakes Action Network. Thanks a lot, sir, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We also have with us today Julius Mbaluto, an African affairs analyst, who will also briefly contribute to our conversation. Welcome again to our program, Mr. Mbaluto.
My pleasure.
Now, human rights groups and refugee organizations have called Britain's plan to send refugees to Rwanda as cruel, inhumane, and neo-colonial. Mr. Gatebuke, do you agree with this description?
Absolutely. The only thing I would add is a few other things. It's not only cruel, inhumane, and neo-colonialist, it's also human trafficking. It is the trade of humans in selling people to, you know, trading people for money. It's similar to the slave trade. It's basically modern day slave trade. And by the way, this is just a legalized way of trafficking human beings. So that would be my one additional remark to that. So calling it cruel, inhumane, and neocolonial is true. It also, there is just a stench of white supremacy, where you think people that you do not desire or individuals that you do not desire, that you could just take them and dump them, basically throw them away and just pay the money to throw them away and send them to an African country.
Rwanda is a country that has experienced deadly ethnic and political tensions and produces many refugees itself. This tiny and densely populated country suffered a devastating genocide in 1994, where more than 800,000, mostly ethnic Tutsis, were massacred. Opposition leader Frank Habineza warns that the influx of new refugees could be dangerous for the country.
Conflicts are inevitable. When people come in and you say you're going to give them those £120 million and they are going to live a very good life, whereas other Rwandans, they don't have anything the same way as that, then be sure that there will be conflicts, that people will say, oh, so these people are living a better life than us. Yeah, so there'll be conflicts. Then there'll also be conflicts on natural resources, competition. We don't have land, and if the Americans are going to settle here, that means we'll be given land. They'll be also put into the national budget like others, because that money is only for 5 years. Afterwards, we don't know what will happen.
Why did Britain decide to select Rwanda, one of the most densely populated countries in the world and one of the tiniest countries in Africa?
There's not even the space for the people there, but Britain and Rwanda both have a lot to gain from each other. Rwanda will gain PR, which it's badly in need of because of the way they treat their abysmal and horrible human rights record. And the British get to play the card that will please Prime Minister Boris Johnson's constituents. I'm not sure that they all even like that idea. I think they just thought if we dump immigrants and turn the issue to the immigrants, everything will be fine. Everything is about money. You know, Britain is going to gain, politically, especially the party in power. And Rwanda is going to gain money, but the people who are being dumped to Rwanda are going to suffer, like other refugees who have who have sought refuge in Rwanda.
The UN refugee agency, UNHCR, also voiced opposition to the UK-Rwanda refugee deal. Assistant High Commissioner for Protection, Gillian Trick, says people fleeing war, conflict, and persecution deserve compassion and empathy. They should not be treated like commodities and transferred abroad for processing.
Triggs described the Rwanda-US deal as shifting asylum responsibilities and evading international obligations that are contrary to the letter and spirit of the Refugee Convention. Now, let's bring in Mr. Mbaluto. What's your take on Britain's decision to literally dump refugees into Rwanda?
When you look into the UK, their position is like they want to exploit freedoms that came because of Brexit. But if you know what was the driving force with the Brexit, was extreme racism, and it was really not really such a great thing. In UK leaving Europe was not driven because of good reasons, but more than, you know, wanting to be independent, make decisions, not be controlled by European Court of Law, which was all the time reinforcing human rights when they were being violated within the UK territory.
Well, now, despite some positive economic indicators, Rwanda is still among the world's 25 poorest countries. Now, Britain's use of cash to entice Rwanda to accept the deal is considered as some form of exploitation.
Britain claims to be a champion of human rights, but it breaches its international commitments and responsibilities by sending refugees to Rwanda.
If you'd only listen to the claims by these nations, you know, claiming to be, to respect human rights, you might believe it. But when you look at some of the practices in Britain, when it comes to immigrants and refugees, I mean, in recent years, there were refugee and immigrant protest, you know, showing that, you know, their rights were not highly respected. But if you look at human rights, you can't just confine yourself to inside of the country and to claim the person, the country that simply claims to be a champion for human rights.
Britain's opposition leader has also slammed the government's plan to send illegal immigrants to Rwanda to have their claims processed. Let's listen in.
I think we need to see these plans for what they are. It's a desperate announcement by a Prime Minister who just wants to distract from his own law-breaking. You know, they're unworkable, they're extortionate, they're going to cost taxpayers billions of pounds, and they just reflect a Prime Minister who's got no grip, no answers to the questions that need answering, and no shame. And I just think Britain deserves better than this. I think it's a desperate announcement. The true aim of this is just to distract from the law-breaking of the Prime Minister. And that's why I say It shows that he's got no answers, he's got no grip, he's got no shame. It's a desperate announcement, unworkable, extortionate, and Britain really does deserve better than this.
Boris Johnson's Rwanda migrant announcement has been termed as an attempt to divert attention from the Partygate scandal. What's your take on this, Mr. Mbaluto?
When you look into all these scandals surrounding the Prime Minister and all the criticism, you know, all the attention that drew, you may wonder whether it was a move to kill bad news. Bad news, I'm talking about the scandals, the Partygate scandal, COVID, handling of the COVID, and everything that was all around it. Of course, we see still ongoing, but he refused to resign. He apologized. He was fined by the police only £50.
Okay, we thank Mr. Mbaluto for his insight, and we now take a short break. When we come back, we shall continue the discussion on the controversial plan by Britain to forcefully send asylum seekers to Rwanda. So stay with us.
Inhuman UK-Rwanda Refugee Pact. You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back to this week's edition of Africa Today, which is focusing on an inhumane Rwanda-UK deal on refugees. Now, the Israeli regime also struck secret deals in 2013 with Rwanda and Uganda to transfer asylum seekers from Sudan and Eritrea. Rwanda's last migrant deal with the Israeli regime ended in disaster. Now, can you elaborate on the fate of the refugees dumped by the Israeli regime into Rwanda?
There are the Eritreans and the Sudanese refugees who were part of a deal with Israel. And I know we may be talking about this a little bit later, but I want to, you know, just put it all together. There's a group of refugees from Israel. They were Eritrean and Sudanese. There was a plan to send to Rwanda 4,000 refugees, $5,000 a head. So they were selling them, basically. You know, Rwanda was doing the trade with Israel to trade the refugees. Rwanda was going to make $20 million off of the deal. They started with a pilot. The initial refugees, the Eritrean refugees that they sent to Rwanda, were distorted of their money by Rwandan officials who were supposed to resettle them in Rwanda. They took their money. They put them in horrible living conditions. They raped the women. And they impregnated children. Some of those refugees were dumped at the border of Uganda after they took away all their papers and everything. Those refugees ended up in Libya in slavery. And some of them have made their way all the way back to Europe. So it hasn't worked even previously when it was done. That deal ended up falling apart.
The then Prime Minister of the Israeli regime, Benjamin Netanyahu, pursued the inhumane deal to forcefully deport African refugees in an attempt to please his supporters in Israel. To capitalize on the xenophobia and anti-African sentiments he has encouraged when he came to power in 2009. Is Boris Johnson taking cue from Netanyahu by sending refugees to Rwanda to deflect attention from the Partygate scandal?
It's always the easy escape when it comes, as I said before, to white supremacy. white supremacy basically looks at black and brown people, non-white people, as objects. And the Boris Johnson government, facing Partygate, found the objects that they could basically dump, where they could deflect the attention. And the deflection of attention went to the immigrants and the black and brown people, basically, for the most part. So it's similar game. It's a similar play. It's same playbook when it comes to when these Western leaders are in trouble, they turn to racism, xenophobia, and white supremacy. And that is what happened with the Boris Johnson government trying to deal with Partygate.
The controversial arrangement between Rwanda and the Israeli regime on the deportation of asylum seekers failed when the refugees who had their documents taken away and were offered no protection escaped Rwanda to embark on a dangerous journey to Europe. An African immigrant in the occupied territories voiced his opposition to the deportation deals.
I see the situation now is very, very difficult, very bad. We are in the world. How can it be? I'm not Uganda, I'm not Rwanda. How can it be that the government decides people to send them to other countries? ובלי שום אישור, בלי מסמכים, בלי שום דבר. איך אפשר למכור אותנו כאילו אנחנו עבדים? מה אנחנו? איך? איך זה יכול להיות? אחרי 10 שנים.
Will Rwanda's refugee deal with Britain suffer the same fate that befell a similar pact with the Israeli regime that collapsed?
It's possible that the deal will see a similar fate because there is a lot of resistance, but it's really going to depend on how much the British taxpayers and the British public and Parliament gets in, you know, gets involved, because that is how the and also the organization, the pressure from around the world to stop the deal, because even the deal in Israel, which was not as highly publicized as this one, was highly resisted. There were many organizations, human rights organizations around the world, including our own, that were a part of resisting that deal. And so I think it's going to depend on the pressure. For the most part, really, pressure is what's going to make it work. But then also the response by the British public to the deal. Right now, it looks like it may fall apart, but you never know.
The UK-Rwanda refugees deal has several precedents. European powers have been targeting Africa for similar agreements since migration pressures increased in 2015. Many African countries and the African Union have rejected such agreements.
In 2021, the African Union slammed reports of a law passed by the Parliament in Denmark to relocate asylum seekers to countries outside the European Union while their cases are being processed. The African Union termed such a move as xenophobic and completely unacceptable.
Rwanda agreed to take in immigrants denied entry into the United Kingdom, even as Kenya declined London's requests to help it ease the burden of unwanted guests. Kenya, which already hosts over 800,000 refugees, most in camps and others in urban centers across the country, reportedly declined Britain's offer to take in the migrants.
According to reports, before making the partnership deal with Rwanda, the UK had approached other countries in the region, including Kenya, which declined the request on a cost-benefit analysis. A Kenyan political analyst, Mustafa Ali, says Western colonial powers are in fact the root cause of the current refugee crisis. Let's take a listen.
Upstream and check what is the problem upstream. And this is what Britain should have done. They should be checking the first world, the so-called first world, the international community. Why is it that these many young people are leaving Africa to want to go to Europe? Obviously, there are challenges in Africa. And of course, it starts with our leadership, our leaders, to try and address some of those challenges. There are challenges that are beyond our leaders, that are actually caused by just the unjust international system, international community. And the West, particularly Britain, cannot escape blaming this. colonialism and the kind of subjugation that some of the European countries put Africa to during colonial times, still a big cause of poverty in Africa.
Now, why did Britain approach Kenya first, and what prompted the authorities in Nairobi to reject the plan?
The fact that they declined, I'm not sure why, but I know one thing. Many countries have refused to accept deportees, people who are deported from Western countries. In fact, in places, especially in the Caribbean, for example, places like Jamaica and Trinidad and many other places, a lot of the deportees have become the biggest criminals, violent criminals in those countries. So many countries have refused to accept deportees. And what is happening with the British deal with Rwanda is basically a forced deportation without due process to a place that's not even home. That is what's happening. And so those may be the reasons why Kenyan authorities refuse, but I'm not 100% sure. But I know based on what's happened in other places, those may be the reasons.
Rwandan President Paul Kagame now says the UK approached him over the sending of refugees to his country, as he had helped refugees during his time as African Union chairperson. He also rejected accusations that his deal with Britain was tantamount to slave trade.
This is why I was saying there are things you can't buy about us. Yes. We are who we are, and we are proud people too. We are not involved in buying and selling of people, Rwanda and the UK, or anybody. No, it's just a problem that people will have different views about it. They look at it differently. They're not happy about it. That's okay. People will have look at, but at the end of the day, you've got to do something.
The president of Rwanda has defended the deal, claiming it was not about trading people, but it will offer a chance to asylum seekers to begin a new life. Now, what's your take on this, Mr. Getabuke?
At the end of the day, it's all about the money and PR that Kagame, Paul Kagame is who I'm referring to, is going to make off of the people. The government under Kagame, the Rwandan regime under Kagame, under the RPF, is going to make off of the people. That's what it's about. It's about getting money, getting resources, because it is a poor country. And it's also about public relations, you know, having this image of, you know, we are giving human beings a place to begin a new life when even the people there are actually wanting to leave. Last point, Rwanda has one of the highest refugee population on the African continent. It's not only the most highly densely populated country, but it has one of the largest numbers of people who have left the country and to this day are unwilling to return. So Rwanda can't even give a new life and hope to Rwandans who have fled the regime, but they're claiming that they can provide it to the people that Britain wants to trade with them in this human trafficking deal to resettle them and give them a chance at new life. That is a big, bold-faced lie.
Well, I'd like to thank Mr. Claude Getabuke for his incisive analysis. There you have it. The United Kingdom is basically engaged in a human trafficking deal with Rwanda. Let us know what you think about this controversial deal. Well, that's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you. You can send us your comments through our social media handle, and goodbye for now. We'll be right back.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Very warm welcome to the program Islamic Upbringing. This is your host Zainab. I hope wherever you are, you're fine, you're doing well. And in case you have any problems, you're not doing well, in this holy land, we always pray for your well-being, inshallah. Thank you so much for listening. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we come up with the issues, the problems, the questions that parents have about the upbringing of their children. Well, the answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations from the Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. We have in studio with us our guest speaker, Sister Salma Khalafan. Assalamu alaikum, sister.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome to our program.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming.
It's my pleasure.
Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, said, I like the fight between the kids because they don't keep it for the long time. They patch up very soon. If the same thing is given a right direction, right upbringing, our kids may turn into what we really want them. But as we have teens, once the kids turn to teenage, they are like full of energy, they are rebellious, they don't want to listen to anyone. So as a teenager, should we listen to our parents all the time? I mean, when someone turns somewhat around 18, Do their parents have their legislative control over their kids?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Here, we are talking about Islam. We're not talking about the West or the laws of the West. Because becoming an adult is not defined by the age of 18 or 21 in Islam.
True.
It's defined by the age of taklif, the age of responsibility, when you're accorded some duties that you have to perform. A person come of age has to perform it for a girl as well as a boy. So these are responsibilities that are religious and they're accountable for it.
All right.
You know, when they reach the age of puberty, that's when these responsibilities are given because they can rationally think about it
mm-hmm.
and they can undergo those responsibilities also. So as Muslims, we also know, for one, is that the adult that they think is at the age of 18, we think that an adult for a girl is 9 and a boy is 15.
All right.
And he can actually go undergo responsibilities. And then in Islam also, as far as we know, obedience to parents has no age limit. So all it doesn't right. mean that by the age of 18, you know, that he can do whatever he wants. No, as old as you get, as young as you are, you have that, you know.
You mean to say once a child reaches the age of puberty and is able to follow the jurisprudic rulings and all and able to differentiate between the good and bad, that's where it starts actually.
Even before that, we encourage that let your child obey you. You know, there is right. The difference between the ages of the 7 years difference that you have to train your child in such a way that they should listen to you.
Yeah.
And they should be your abd like the next 7 years. For a boy, he has not turned the age of puberty yet. So it goes all along the lifetime, you know, this obedience to parents. And Quran has also stressed so much on it, you know, that Rabbir Hamhuma Kamara Bayani Sagira, you know, and then Walatakullahuma Uffin Walatan Harhuma Wakullahuma Kaulan Karima. All these ayats, you know, stress upon the fact that one has to act so much honorable and with so much humility towards the parents.
All right.
So it doesn't mean that the age of 18, you know, gives you all the choices to make. Okay.
All
so,
right.
The status of parents is above everything. And that's why we should not see it as a control. Like, you know, they have wilayat over us. But that doesn't mean that it's like a control that is dictatorship or something like that.
All right.
It's completely out of love. So there's no negative control here.
And out of experience, parents always can guide you towards the right path. They have gone
that's
through
right.
that
they have the best of interests for
True.
Us. So parents have authority over us, and in most cases, although not all cases, they want the best for us, as you said. And as we grow, we must increase the level of obedience to our parents, because our parents are getting older, you see. So
right.
as we grow, they need us more.
All
so
right.
how can that 18-year-old claim that now, you know, I can make
now
my own decisions, they
are controlling
maybe
over
to
me.
Go away from home or something like that, or not to listen to them
sure.
or to disobey them.
I'll be talking to you here.
Yeah.
We need to take a short break. Okay. Tell listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is the program Islamic Upbringing, and I have with me Sister Salma Khalafan, who is talking about the teens who claim that parents kind of control us while they don't want to listen to them, while they don't want to obey to them. So yeah, sister, I want you to continue.
Yeah, and we as parents also, we want to show that to our children so that they can remember this good quality, that you know how to treat them with love. And we have to struggle enough to show them the ways and methods so that when we are old enough, they can go along with the legacy. They can be treated the same way
True.
By their children, you know. So we have shown to our children the right Islamic way of how to treat elders.
Yeah.
So that they can also learn to treat us in a gentle way. And then their children will learn how to, you know, behave in front of them.
So are you trying to say that in case a child is not very much kind of obeying his parents, it's somewhere parents have been lacking in the upbringing of the children?
It might be so, but the thing is, like, in any condition, the child has to obey the parents, except as far as disobedience to Allah is concerned. For example, if the child is told not to pray or not to perform hijab, then the child has the right not to only not do to that listen. Action.